Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Broke Girl Society podcast. I'm your host, Christina. Thank you so much for listening in. So today's episode I pulled from the vault, and it's one that we had every intention of re-recording, but we just never got to it. And then I found out that my friend and guest, Tiffany Kay, passed away in January 2024, and I was utterly heartbroken. We had always said we would re-record this episode, and you know, life just got in the way. I went on and I did an episode for her podcast, Gambling Got the Girls, which she co-hosted with Danielle. And we collaborated on a few other projects for the BGS. And she was an inspiration for me, especially early in my recovery. She connected me to a lot of people. She held her own women's preferred meetings. She was really active in the gambling harm community for a while. And I want to honor her spirit and the light that she shared with all of us and the hope that she shared for recovery. And so I dusted off this episode. I edited it the best that I could. One of the reasons we shelved it was because there were some audio issues and she was sick in this episode. And so I know that she would still be proud to have her message given. And so I'm going to go ahead and release this episode so that you guys can help me honor her and all the work that she did in this community. So here we go. The Broke Girl Society podcast is sponsored by the Better Institute, where people go to get better. For more information about their services and where they're located, visit betterinstitute.com. And we're also sponsored by Birch's Health, an online therapy platform for gambling addiction recovery. For more information on their services, visit birchishealth.com. And today we have Tiff, who's joining us. She co-hosts Gambling Got the Girls with Danielle. And I'm just really enjoying the thought of having a great conversation with her. So hi, Tiff.
Hey, Christina, what's up? Hey. Audience.
Yeah.
Glad to be here.
I'm glad you are here. I'm glad you're taking the time. Now let's talk about this. You are sick with COVID, right?
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
I just want to share this with everybody listening.
I was just going to like try to fake it till I make it, but okay. I'm going to just be honest. That's what we learn in recovery. Like, hey.
Let's just get out there.
I do have COVID. I'm like day four of COVID actually. So yeah.
Well, the reason why I brought it up, I'm just kind of curious, maybe for somebody listening who hasn't experienced it, like, how are you feeling?
I'm very grateful for vitamins and supplements, and I've been able to kind of heal myself with just taking a lot of fluids and just resting a lot. I've rested more than I have in a while. So maybe it's kind of teaching me to just slow down a bit, but was not expecting to get COVID.
Yeah, I don't think any of us do.
Yeah. But I'm doing well. I'm on the mend, and I really wanted to be a part of this podcast. So that's why I'm on here. I sound crazy, but I'll do the best I can.
Well, you'll be great. Okay. So let's just go ahead and dive in. Do you want to just kind of tell us your story? I am always fascinated by it. In your recovery. So if you just want to kind of give us some history.
Sure. Well, my gambling career, I guess you would call it, started when I turned 21. My parents actually thought it would be a great idea for myself and them to go to Atlantic City to celebrate my 21st birthday. This was back in like 2003. I'm like dating myself. And we decided to go to the Claridge Casino in Atlantic City. I'm not sure if it still exists. I believe it does, but it's a relatively old casino. But anyway, my parents, they were always gamblers. So they thought it would be a good idea for me to be celebrating this event with them. So when I walked in, I remember just the sights and sounds of how, like, I don't know, it was exciting, you know, as a 21-year-old, you know, just walking through, hearing people like hooping and hollering, you know, the thought of winning money. So they kind of like showed me a little bit of how to play the games. There's so many different games at the casino. So that was exciting because I'm the type of person, I don't like the same things. I like games that have like different things involved. I get bored very easily. So it was kind of nice to have like go to these different slot machines. So on my way out, I actually won $1,200. And I guess you can call that beginner's luck, but for me, that was like the beginning of my gambling career. Like I had a little taste of like winning, and that was just something that I wanted to chase. So anyway, that happened. And then over the years, my parents and I would go to Atlantic City, you know, as a quality time thing. But then the casino in Philadelphia opened, I'm not sure, like mid 2000s, maybe late 2000s. And we went there because it was a lot closer for me to, for us to go there than Atlantic City. So we went there instead. And they offered a lot more comps. So like, of course we would go there. At first it started off as fun, but I noticed as we kept going, I would initially play with them, but then I would separate myself and go play on my own. And just find the machines that I loved. But in the meantime, I would spend like a lot of money and like hit up the ATM and not tell them. Like I would always like look over my shoulder and see where they were relative to where I was. So if I had to go get money, it would be like no problem for me to do that.
I did that too. I would hide if I was with somebody and I didn't want them to know. Like, yeah. Okay. So sorry.
No, that's good. Yeah. So like, I think that was like my first sign of me possibly like having a problem. So this started like really early. But, you know, when I would lose money, I felt like bad about it. It hadn't become like an addiction yet, because I know that as my addiction got worse, I think I started feeling less remorse as I lost more money. So in the beginning, I was just like, I hated that I lost money and I felt bad longer. So just to kind of back up, like as a history, my dad actually was a compulsive gambler, and I witnessed his gambling like growing up. He would often like play the lottery. And a lot of times if he won, my mom and I would kind of turn the other way because it would benefit us, you know. It would only be a problem if like it like caused like, I guess, harm. Like immediate harm. My mom, like I said, is also a gambler, but she was more responsible. So his gambling problem became like such a thing that they separated their accounts. I remember this when I was growing up. And I also remember as a teenager, my dad asked me for money to fund his gambling. And I used to hate that, because it's like, what's wrong with you? Like, why are you hitting up your daughter for money, you know? And, you know, I end up doing the same thing, oddly enough, so. So yeah, like gambling was always a part of my childhood in some way. So yeah, like throughout the years, we would go to Parks Casino. A lot of times I would go off on my own. I would go without them in my mid-20s. A lot of times too, like I would sometimes go with a friend, but I used to hate the way she gambled. She gambled too conservatively for me. And like, she would want to go there just to, you know, just to be in the atmosphere, just to socialize. I didn't go there for that. I wanted to be
crazy, right? They wanted to go there and do it normally, yeah, and responsibly. Yeah. And like,
yeah, I'm just like, wait, like, and I would get annoyed with how she like gambled, because like she wouldn't bet enough to me. Like, I was just like, what are you doing? Like, why are you betting like 50 cents? Like, you're not gonna win that. I'm just like, and then when she would win, I'd be annoyed because I would think she'd make all this noise for like winning like 50 bucks. And I'm just like, oh, is that okay?
that's when you know that we're way past jaded. You know,
yeah, like we have a problem. Yeah. I even did that when I, you know, I wasn't with her. Like when somebody would hoop and holler, I would like, it would gain my attention, but then I'd look and I'd just be like, oh wait, what are they yelling about? Like $100?
Same thing. Yeah, I'd be like, oh come on, you know. And then
I'm like, I would be annoyed that you took my attention. Like, what are you doing?
And it's just awful thinking back on it now, isn't it? You're just like, oh my gosh. Yeah. Like,
I'm the crazy one here.
Not them. Exactly.
Yeah. So like, I definitely had a problem. And like throughout the years, I started becoming my parents' caregiver, you know, cause I am the youngest, and I did live with my parents up until they passed. So I was just I just went to gamble just to kind of escape like the responsibility of having to take care of them. And then like, I worked a lot too, because I felt like I felt entitled, like I deserve this, I'm entitled to this. So like a lot of like this thinking of like, this entitlement, like I need stress relief because of all the stress I'm dealing with at home. So it became definitely an escape for me. In 2012, I had just turned 30 and I was going to move out. You know, I had been saving to pay for a down payment on a house. I had been looking, I had a real estate agent and everything. That's the year I found out my mom had cancer. And it was very hard to deal with, especially since, let me back up. I had a sister that also had cancer. She had a different type, but you know, to have two people in my immediate family like deal with that was very heartbreaking. I decided, you know, I'm not going to like leave my mom in her time of need. So, you know, I didn't move out. But instead of saving that money, I just like pissed it away gambling, because I just couldn't deal with the turmoil and just the uncertainty of what was going to happen. So that happened. So that was in 2012. Yeah, there was more turmoil to come. So in 2014, I would say was like one of the worst years of my life, because my sister who had cancer, she was diagnosed in 2001 and went to remission in 2007, and then it came back in stage four. She passed away in May of 2014. So that was heartbreaking. And then September, my dad passed away.
Oh my goodness.
Heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
Then in January, my mom passed away. When I tell you I did not know a freaking deal, is an understatement. I was completely devastated.
I can only imagine.
Oddly enough, though, I don't think I was really gambling, just because I didn't have the means to gamble. Because I had pissed away so much money. Now I was kind of like in survival mode. Like, well, my parents didn't really have anything like set up before they passed. It kind of like just. It happened, and then just trying to go through court and all this other stuff. So it was like a big mess. So I'm sitting here trying to figure out, like, you know, I have to get a second job and I have to fund their home. Like the house was already paid off, but like taxes and just the maintenance of the house, I had to like figure that out. And this was like the dead of winter when my mom passed. So it was like alone in this house, dealing with all this heartache, like paying like to buy oil for the house, like all this stuff that I didn't even think of.
Right.
I had to like fund. So I wasn't gambling at this point. I was just trying to survive. Felt like I was pretty much alone in the situation. I would say around August, like July, August, I wanted to move out. You know, I had been living in that house, you know, since my mom had passed in like late January up until like July. I wanted to get out of there just because I couldn't stand the memories. So I actually like put an ad in for Craigslist. I was looking for like roommates, and I just like randomly found these people. They were like amazing. And I actually like moved into a couple's home in 2015. So they provided the family that I was missing. It was a great experience. It was me, them as a couple, and then they had two other people that they were subletting their rooms in their house. So it was interesting. So I had actually had been there in August 2015, and then that's when the healing process started. I was able to kind of pick up the pieces of my life. All this was happening. My sister and I were trying to figure out what to do with my parents' house, because it was already paid off. It was just a means of like, what do we do? Do we keep it? Do we sell it? My sister wanted to sell it. I didn't, but I couldn't buy her out. So I had to sell it, my share. So in 2016, the house sold, and we got a nice chunk of change. And I think that's when the gambling started again, because now I had money to gamble. And I was starting to like heal in terms of like the grief and all that. And now I just felt like I'm bored. I'm still grieving, but I miss this familiar thing that I used to do with my parents. Like I said, this was like quality time thing. So it goes deeper than just going to the casino. It's just like something we did together. So I started going there. I started going to the parks again by myself, usually on weeknights. sometimes on Fridays, weekends too. Because my job, I work second shift, so I was able to do that, stay out late and go into work later, because I worked like a 10-6 shift and I worked 4 days a week. So it was very easy for me to gamble. So yeah, I did that. And I think my gambling really got out of control in 2018, because that's when I left my job of 10 years to pursue a different career path, something that would give me more growth. But in me doing that, it was kind of like the last anchor of my old life, the life I'd had with my parents, the life that, it was like the last thing that I had. And that kind of sent me into like a tailspin. Because I've gone from like job to job that year. I had like 5 jobs in 2018, and I was completely like, I just was all over the place. And that's when my gambling really got out of control. And then my rationalization of like how much money I was spending got out of control. Because I always thought to myself, I could just make more money. If I just work more, it's no problem. It's fine. Nobody's being hurt. I rationalized a lot, because I figured I was not hurting anyone except like myself, but it's like, it's just me, who cares, you know? Kind of was just out of control until May 2019. And that's when I went into GA for the first time. It was May 5th, Cinco de Mayo. Yeah. But yeah, I walked to my first GA meeting, and I just like, oh man, there's nothing but a bunch of dudes in here. I am not ready for this at all, you know? So that was intimidating. I went through it anyway. But then, you know, a few minutes later, another female did show up. So that was reassuring. But I went through the 20 questions, all that. A couple days after the meeting, this female like reached out to me and just said, "Hey, how you doing?" And that was reassuring to me, because, I didn't think I could do it. And it was just really nice for like a complete stranger to just ask me how I was doing. Not like, "Hey, are you gambling?" Not like anything judgmental.
Yeah.
It was more like, "Hey, like, how are you?" Which
like,
I appreciate.
"Are you okay? Are you okay?" Yeah.
I don't want to be like judged because I'm having urges. You know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
So that was reassuring. So I thought, okay, I have a chance. So then my biggest thing was to go to a lot of meetings, because A, it filled a lot of time, and B, I needed to build my network because I don't have a spouse. I don't have anyone keeping me accountable at home. I had to like build those relationships in these rooms. I knew that from the beginning, I needed to do that. So I went to a lot of meetings in the beginning, and it was really great for a while. I was very much like gung-ho with recovery. And I have to like, I'm very much like that with a lot of stuff. So like, I enjoyed the newness of recovery, because I was like, oh, let me try this thing. It's great. But I feel like I was doing a lot of like Texas two-stepping, and they talk about that in like GA. And what that really is like, you're just working step 1 and 12. So 1 is the unmanageability, the powerlessness. And step 12 is carrying the message. But I really wasn't doing recovery. I was kind of like white knuckling it, essentially. I went to a few meetings, and I thought like I knew everything. I actually had like a slip. So I went to a baseball game with a roommate that I had. And I put my name into a raffle, didn't think anything of it. And like a month later, I won, right? So these people call me and they say, "Oh, Tiff, you like won this and that." I think it actually was like a trip to Atlantic City, like ironically enough. And I just remember like how I reacted, like physiologically, like I felt like my heart was racing. I'm like, oh my God, this is exciting. But in those moments of me like realizing that, I'm like, oh my God, I think this is gambling. Just based on how I reacted to it, I'm like, oh my, what do I do? So I was kind of like wrestling with this idea of, is this gambling? Is this not gambling? When in my heart, I knew from me, it was gambling. But do I tell anyone is the other question.
Right. So, and I think it's kind of different for other people, you know, like some people kind of struggle with that. Like are sweepstakes or those kinds of things, are they considered gambling? But I guess it's really just up to the person and how it makes you feel. Right. So if it gives you a high, then it's kind of maybe you know,
a trigger.
Yeah, a trigger or something like that. Yeah.
So yeah, I was just like, damn, like, what do I do? So I actually ended up talking to, I guess you can call him my grand sponsor. So he's my sponsor's sponsor. And he's like, yeah, you have to change your bed date. And I was just so angry because I had worked so hard to like get, at the time it was like 4.5 months I was bed free. And then this happened, you know, I had every intention of just, you know, not gambling. And then this like little insignificant thing that I did, not thinking, you know, and then that was my slip. So I ended up changing my bet date from May 5th to September 22nd. And that's what it's been ever since. But man, I was mad.
Yeah, I imagine.
But then I thought to myself, this is an opportunity that I can actually approach recovery differently and not be so like all or nothing and work more towards balance. Because I feel like there's such a thing as like too much recovery too. You can be compulsive in anything, honestly.
Right.
So I felt like I had become compulsive in recovery. I just shifted the gambling addiction to recovery. You know, I mean, the recovery is like awesome, but like too much of a good thing, it doesn't matter what it is, it's bad.
I did that in the beginning too. I just delved into it. It's because I think a lot of it's avoidance. Like we don't want to, we're still avoiding the things that we need to be working on. Like those feelings that we need to work through and feel, we're still trying to find ways to avoid them. Right. For me anyway, I didn't want to set with my feelings.
And not only that, for me, it's like, instant gratification. Like I want what I want right now. Like
exactly.
I have no patience for anything. So it's
very, very true.
Like,
yeah.
Let's go. Cause I feel like I'm behind in my life because of the whole gambling BS. So now I have to like take catch up now.
Yeah.
I've lost so many years.
Oh, same. Yeah.
But it's like, okay, this did not happen overnight. So it stands to reason. you're not going to fix all your problems overnight either. So I had to like think about that. So I came back into recovery with a different mindset. I deleted all of social media in 2019, like December, because I knew Facebook has these games that are very similar to casino games. And it was a trigger for me. And I said to myself, I don't want to have this as a trigger. Then also too, like Facebook was very distracting to me. And I just felt like it was a waste of time. So I was just fine with deleting that. So I had like no social media going into 2020. So then 2020, you know, I was still doing recovery. At this point, I started going to like church because I noticed in some of my home meetings, there's this GA brother that I'm very like close with. He actually kind of took me under his wing when I first joined GA. He sounded very different. His therapy sounded different than everyone else's. And I'm just like, what is he doing that we're not doing? And he told me about this group. So I kind of added that to my recovery. It was like a Wednesday night group. Called Overcomers, pretty much like come as you are. This is for anybody who has like any type of addiction, hang up, anxiety, anything like that. So I really gravitated towards that. That was great because I was never like a spiritual person. And like, I know for me, like GA is rooted in like spiritual principles. So it's like, I need to get the spiritual stuff because I'm not going to get anywhere if I don't like work on the spiritual side of myself.
Right. But
I had like no foundation with at all. So I started going to this group, and then that's when like right around the same time, maybe a month and a half, that's when COVID happened and everything shut down. Now, a couple weeks before COVID, I had met a female at one of the in-person meetings, and she was telling me about Reddit. She told me about like podcasts that she had listened to. So she had done all this before she even like went to a GA meeting. And I just thought to myself, like, that's interesting. I was very much Miss GA. Like there's no other way to recover. Like that's cute and everything. Like you're doing a whole podcast thing, but like, girl, like I was very arrogant thinking like there's only one way to recover. So she was telling me about, you know, the different things that she was using as her tools of recovery. I was like, that's cute and everything. But then COVID happened and then there were no meetings. So I'm like, crap, what am I going to do? So she helped get me into like WhatsApp group with Brian and Jeff. So that became instrumental for me in terms of my recovery, because had I not even talked to her, or like known, I don't know where I would be in my recovery, honestly, because like I said, there were no meetings when COVID shut down. So that changed everything. I got involved with, doing the podcast. I was actually on Jeff's and Brian's podcast, the All In podcast, as like a panel person. It was me and Danielle and a few other people on Wednesday nights. We would do it every week. It started like in April to about like June. And in between then, Brian had approached Danielle and I about doing our own podcast. And I just was like, what? I never thought in a million years that I would be co-hosting my own podcast. But he suggested, hey, like you can do a 6 episode run of your podcast on All In. So we had to come up with a name. Gambling Out the Girls was our name. I think Danielle's sponsor came up with that. So we took that name and we did 6 episodes and it went really well. So that was from like June to September. Also at the same time, I was involved with the Council on Compulsive Gambling of New Jersey. I'm a board member and I applied to be on the board last year. I got on in August. So I'm actually going into my second year of serving on there. So yeah, I was very active in recovery. So September 22nd, I hit my first year gamble free. It was awesome. Few people came out. At this point, we started having in-person meetings. And then I think that's when things started to take a dive in terms of my recovery, because they talk about the second year curse and I experienced it. So I had done so much in my first year that I was trying to figure out, okay, where do I go from here? I had done so much and I just felt like, what's next? You know, through all that, I started to like get a little depressed because I hadn't like made any goals for like my next move. And that's when I feel like I started pulling away from the things that I love doing. Like I started pulling away from meetings. I became like less willing to like do the women's preferred meeting. Oh, that's another thing. So Danielle and I started a women's preferred meeting in June of last year. And that was something that we promoted on the podcast, but I started like not wanting to be in love with that either. Like all these different things that I loved, I just started questioning, am I doing this for my recovery? Am I people pleasing? You know, am I people pleasing? Am I getting a dopamine hit just by doing all these things? Like I was questioning this like constantly.
Did you feel burnt out at all? Were you feeling just burnt out?
I was feeling burnt out. And then I was, like I said, I just didn't know what my actual real intentions were. So I started getting like depressed and just, I was like, I don't know why I'm doing any of this stuff. It was really, really crazy. And then all these different things started happening, different changes in my life that it just perpetuated the isolation and the questioning. So in December, I had my roommate that I had, she had to leave abruptly. So I was basically in this like 1500 square condo by myself in the dead of winter with my own thoughts. And that's not a good place to be.
Yeah.
So that happened. And then in January, my supervisor, she put her notice in and I was just like, wait, what? Cause she was very much like, she just like, she had her stuff together and she just was very like, she did her job very well. I just felt comforted, like knowing that she was my manager. But then the fact that like she was leaving, I'm just, it kind of was like, it threw me. And I did not adjust to the change well at all. So, I mean, that really affected me. So basically she had to train myself and 2 of my other coworkers her job essentially, which we hadn't even really known up until like 3 weeks before she resigned. And then all of a sudden, like, here, guys, this is what you're going to be doing. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
What are you talking about right now? So it was really stressful.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It's like, okay. So she trained us the best she could. And then she was like, all right, guys, it's all up to you. And I'm like, wait, what? Wait. And then, it's just like, okay, so we're just out here. We don't know what to even ask or who to even ask. It was just like a mess. And like all that, while this was all happening, I was just in that isolation and just like, now my thoughts had started becoming very like very dark, like, oh, you're not worth anything. You can't even keep up with your coworkers because they're a lot younger than me. So like they technologically, I feel like, are probably like faster getting things because my job is very Excel based. I'm just in Excel like all day. And I felt like I couldn't keep up. And then like my own thoughts were tormenting me like, oh, you're no good. You're going to get fired, like awful stuff. So I just felt like I was trying to like find answers in people instead of like really like going to the source, which is my higher power first.
Right.
Had I done that in the beginning, I felt like I would have saved so much like heartache. Because at you know, one point I just felt like suicidal. I just felt like I gave up on life. I was just like basically like waiting to die. Like that's how bad it was. I was involved with self-mutilation. It was awful. So once I surrendered myself in terms of like my life's out of control, you know, surrender myself, not with gambling, but surrender myself in the fact that I have no control over my life at all. So I got to give it to like this higher power thing, which I had done in the beginning of my recovery, but I somehow lost that in the middle. And I just had to like give it up to my higher power. And that's why I think things started changing. So now I'm back in recovery. The podcast is going again. I actually got promoted at work. It's just crazy how much I have progressed since like, I'm talking like March to like June.
You know, I had that moment where I was similar. I didn't want to be here anymore. I didn't think I was ever going to be able to beat this addiction. And now here we are having this, you know, you're a friend in my life and a light in my life. And we're having this conversation and we're talking to other women about this addiction that we both have felt so lost in. And it would you say that's contributed to giving this up to your higher power?
It almost like I had to go through what I had to go through because I was very lukewarm in my spiritual walk.
Me too.
So it's like I had to get to like the absolute worst, you know, realize like, okay, like I need this. Like there's no question that I need a higher power. I can't be like so fickle. I have to be like, I have to own it, you know, and it doesn't matter good or bad, like own your spirituality, own your higher power, because that's what's going to bring you through, you know? So that's what that was a lesson I had to learn like the hard way. So.
Yeah. And I think though we need to go through those journeys to really appreciate the other end of it.
Yeah.
At least for me, looking back at it, like, I don't know that I would be doing this podcast and be connecting with so many people had I not gone through what I'd gone through. So yeah, I definitely believe we all have a purpose in life. And, sometimes it's not as clear at times, or we're not as happy with that purpose.
Yeah.
But then it, you know, when you get to that point where you're like, oh, okay. And even just going through the hard stuff that you've gone through, it's like, when I listen to that, I'm like, how are you still standing? You know, like the strength that you have, it's, I mean,
there's no other reason. That's it.
Exactly. Know? Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just, and then when I see you and your strength, and then when you talk to other people, like, what is it like? I get asked this all the time. What is it like just talking with other people, women, about recovery? How is that for you?
It's definitely a passion for mine. It's almost like I have to pinch myself because I can't believe this is my life. I never thought that I could go one day without gambling, let alone almost 2 years. So it's just very humbling, and I feel very honored and blessed to be in the position I'm in. And be able to share that. I'm just an example of what recovery looks like. Anyone can do it. You just have to put forth the effort. That's it. I'm not special. I just decided to just maybe do some extraordinary things. That's it.
Yeah. And that's exactly how I feel. Like when people reach out, you know, I'm like, hey, your recovery can look however you want it to look. Right. You know, it can take you to different passions. It can take you to different, you know, different walks of life, different paths of life. It's all in how you want it to look. And, you know, I always find it really extraordinary when I come across somebody that has just as much passion, for recovery and to help others in recovery, because I think that's part of it. You know, if we hadn't come across those people that awoke that in us, mm-hmm. And you know, like for me, I have people in my life, podcasters in my life that really kind of woke up this passion for me. You know, we talk a lot about Brian being a big inspiration in both of our podcasts, but, you know, or just like Rita, you know, who I had on a few weeks back, who you also are very well acquainted with. I mean, she's wonderful, and to hear her stories and, you know, just to hear stories of people who are 10 plus years, 11 years in her 11 plus years in her case, see that they've lived a fulfilling life without gambling.
I do miss like the action of like, you know, gambling in a sense, but like, you know, I think it's definitely worth just the serenity that I have, just the ability to be able to explore other interests that I may have forgotten about because all the years I gambled, I'm rediscovering again. It's just like, there are so many more things to do besides gambling that I love. Like Zumba, I love Zumba. I talk about Zumba all the time. I don't miss the chaos. I don't miss just the remorse I felt losing all that money. I don't miss any of that stuff, but the excitement, yeah, I do sometimes.
Yeah. And what's your biggest piece of advice that you would tell somebody who's right on the cusp of starting? Like, I'm sure you've met people that are just kind of struggling with starting recovery because they're scared. They don't know what recovery is going to look like for them. They don't know where to start or where to begin. Like, what would be your first thing to tell somebody who's on the cusp of recovery?
Man.
I always ask that because I'm always curious. I always want to know what somebody else's advice would be, because I know what mine would be. Mine would just be stick your toes in it, you know, like really kind of read and just kind of start. The more that you delve into just reading about it or listening to stories, the stronger you kind of get.
Kind of baby steps. So I remember for me, I think what I initially did, I went on a national GA meeting because I was just too scared to go to a physical meeting. So like I went on a national meeting and it's just a phone meeting. And I basically heard how a GA meeting is ran just over the phone. So that was my introduction. I went back out gambling. I'll tell you that much, but it was enough for me to like get familiar with the whole process and like how the format is.
And start thinking about it.
Yeah. And then I went to a meeting. So maybe for someone, it could be like a Zoom meeting where they don't have to go on camera. They can just listen, or go to an open meeting and they can just listen. They don't have to actually give therapy, and just to kind of see what it's all about. You know, I think that would put a lot of people at ease if they just didn't feel pressure to like share therapy. If they just want to go to a couple of meetings, just listen. I've done that. On the women's preferred meeting, I've just let people like come on and just listen. They don't share anything. And I feel like that helps them because they're just getting comfortable.
Oh yeah. I think even now that I go to meetings all the time, some days I just want to listen. Some days I don't necessarily want to share how I'm feeling. Some days I really just want to listen, because just listening is healing to me also, you know, just knowing that I'm not alone in it. You know, kind of thing. Yeah. How did you feel? You talked about when you first walked in and it was like older white men. how do you feel about, like, let's have this conversation. How do you feel about diversity in the recovery community?
Well, certain 12-step programs, I feel, lack diversity. I've actually talked to a few members, high ranking members about this. I feel like the organization's not going to grow just because there's so many old timers with like old views that they're not willing to change. So the new, the younger person, the new person, they're less likely to stick around because A, they don't, there's no representation. So in terms of age, there's a lot of older people in the 12-step programs that I've gone to. So that could be like a hindrance. And then also, like you said, the diversity. So I feel like representation matters. And if somebody doesn't see someone that looks like them, they're not going to stick around. So I feel like that's a big part of why I feel like it's not going to grow, because not enough old timers are like open-minded to changing. And yeah, it's a shame, because I feel like if they change, even if they just start talking more about like internet gambling, all these things that are like in our face nowadays, like internet gambling, sports gambling, you know, they're not really talked about in these meetings.
And they're not. Like, they're not.
Shocking to me, but it's everywhere. Like, we need to talk about that's why there's no young people in these meetings.
Exactly. The ones that have come in usually don't come back. And it's because they're not connecting. You know, in my state, internet gambling or online gambling, it's not as prevalent because it's not legal here. I mean, there's always going to be places you can gamble online, but it's not legal here. So it's not something that we're seeing in the GA meeting so much, but we are seeing people younger and younger. And when you think about the stats, because you work closely with the National Council of Problem Gambling, right? So you see the different stats and things that come in. Do you think that those numbers really match up to what is going on in the states comparatively to problem gambling? I don't
at all. I just feel like, especially with COVID and all this, it's just exploded, and I'm just curious to see the numbers pre-COVID versus now in terms of demographics, like men, women, age, race, all that stuff. I'm just curious. I'm sure there's research, you know, happening with that, but yeah, I don't think the numbers reflect the reality of what's really going on.
How do you think they find those numbers? I always wondered that, because you know how like March, and I'm sure you've wondered this too, you know how like in March, the Problem Gambling Awareness Month, you know, so there's always a lot of like stuff going on in that month and a lot of great information. And I don't ever want to downplay what the National Problem Gambling Council does, because they do play such a huge role in recovery. So I never, I know sometimes I come across harsh when it's talking about the clinical side of recovery, but it makes me wonder, who are they sending these surveys to? Because I've been a problem gambler for 15 years and I've never had a survey come across my mailbox. And if I had, and I've looked at these questions, it certainly wouldn't have been, you know, one of the questions was, do you think a problem gambler is morally corrupt? Well, what does that have to do with the statistics of the people that are needing help and where we're at with it? To me, all that shows is the naivety of problem gambling. You know what I mean? Like, why would that question be relevant to where we need to be providing services for problem gamblers? And I know since you've kind of have a closer ties with that, maybe you can kind of help line me out on that, because I could just be completely off on my thinking.
The questions haven't evolved to what the problem gambler is today. It's still based on like this old like image
1950s
degenerate horse, you know, going to the horse races, having bookies, all this stuff that no one really does like that anymore. It's more like sports gambling, you know, internet gambling, where that is like, that's more like an old way of gambling. It's not what gambling is today. And there's that disconnect of what was and what is.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge problem.
That's a very good way to put it. That's a very good way. It's kind of disconnect. I like that word better, I think, than naive, but that was the only word that came to mind at the moment. But I definitely, that's exactly what it is. It feels like a disconnect. And I'm just always curious, like who gets these surveys? Who do these surveys come out to? So that might be a question I might like.
Retired people who are like at home, like who get mail.
I'm just like, when I saw those questions and kind of the answers to them, and it's like, even one of the questions was, do you think we provide enough services for, this is for my state. Do you think that we provide enough services for problem gambling? Mm. And the way that they answered that was just, there was more people with, I don't know, than yes or no. So in the, I don't know category, you might as well throw that in the no category, because it's like, they don't know, you know, and that to me was really surprising, that this huge number of people didn't know if we were providing enough services for problem gambling, because, well, for one, if they don't have a problem, they wouldn't think about it. Right. So like, it was just kind of interesting, the questions of the survey and kind of the disconnect to it. But how do you feel?
Well, I think also the issue is too, people don't know that these services are out there. So mm-hmm. it's like, because I just started promoting, like on the Gambling Out the Girls podcast, I've started just promoting the Council on Compulsive Gambling of New Jersey, just because a lot of listeners out there, like New Jersey listeners, they don't know that service is out there. Most states have their own council. Mm-hmm. And it's usually state funded. So these services, they can get a low cost or for free in some cases, like, you know, a certain amount of sessions, therapy sessions from GA specialized counselors who know specifically how to treat problem gamblers. Mm-hmm. They don't know these sources are out there. So it's like, I'm trying to do my part of trying to, like, you know,
yeah.
tell like people, like, hey, you may not live in New Jersey, but your state probably has something similar. You just have to like do the research mm-hmm. and find it. Like, so it's just knowing that the source is out there, I think, is a big part of it. Like, a lot of people don't know it's out there. They just know about GA.
I didn't. I was a gambler for 15 years and I didn't even know really about GA. I think maybe had come like randomly at some point, maybe like I did know that GA was out there, but I didn't know anything mm-hmm. about it. I didn't know what it was really entailed, but I didn't grow up with addiction. So I didn't mm-hmm. know anything about AA or NA or any mm-hmm. of those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's the 1-800 number that you see on the door, or maybe mm-hmm. on the flyer that you get. And it's just like, when you're a problem gambler, you don't even think about those things until, you know, it gets to be kind of too late, or too, you know, you're in that dark moment and you're looking for that. It's like, how do we, I guess, doing what we're doing, talking about it, you know, because most states do. In Oklahoma, we mm-hmm. have a problem gambling council. Wiley Harwell is the director of it. And he set up a lot of great programs, like the self-exclusion program for the state. And he's done a lot of great things. We also have teletherapy available mm-hmm. to the whole state, because most of our areas are really rural. So mm-hmm. they don't have access to problem gambling counselors. And that was a really big problem for a long time. And, you know, there's a casino just about everywhere in this state. So that was an amazing thing that our state did. And they just recently did it. So definitely with those. And you've got 1-800-GAMBLER on the East Coast, right?
Well, and to me, it almost seems like, because a lot of times we'll hear that in commercials too, it's almost like an afterthought. Like, I don't think about 800-GAMBLER. Like, I always think, oh, they're talking about like some type of like, okay, lottery. And then it's like, if you have a problem, 1-800, like, you know what I mean? If uh-huh. you have a problem, it was like, it's like a PSA, but it's like rush through. You don't even think about it. And it's like, wait, what? It's an afterthought. It's not promoted. It's like an afterthought. Like, so the focus is on the actual like gambling activity. And then like, if you have a problem, like,
like down, like hush, hush, kind of like the car salesman ad down at the bottom where they start talking about the APR and all that, you know, it's like really rushed and like, very, you're like, wait, what was that?
Yeah.
That's kind of how it is. And it's sad, but, I definitely think, you know, talking more about the resources available and the programs, and it doesn't have to be a GA program. It can be any kind of 12-step program that works for you.